Hi everyone, good afternoon. My name is Kate McAlee. I want to welcome you to our conversation this afternoon. We're very happy that you're here. We don't take your presence for granted and we're excited for this conversation. I just want to say on behalf of the Women's Ordination Conference that we are a feminist affirming organization and we want this to be a safe and inclusive conversation. So just make sure that our language and our dialogue is inclusive, feminist and inclusive, and recognizes the dignity of all people here. I'm happy to introduce our moderator for this conversation, Barb Cozy, who will lead us off in this conversation. So thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Kate. Distinguished guests and panelists, thank you for joining us today for what promises to be an inspiring and thought-provoking discussion titled The Long Shadow of the Church at Beijing, Feminists Reflect. My name is Barbara Ann Cozy, and I am a PhD candidate at Boston College and Vice President of the Women's Ordination Conference Board of Directors. As a delegation with consultative status with the United Nations Economic and Social Council since 2019, and as we approach our 50th anniversary in November of this year, the Women's Ordination Conference remains the uncompromising feminist voice for women's ordination and gender equity in the Roman Catholic Church. We are a grassroots-driven nonprofit organization that advocates for gender equality in both the church and society through activism, dialogue, and prayerful witness. At the United Nations, we aim to shed light on the continued reality of gender exclusion in the RCC and how this impacts women around the globe. Representatives of the Holy See called the UN Beijing Conference of 1995, our source of reflection for today, quote, "step backwards in the field of human rights for women," end quote. Even after its role limiting the forum's defense of women's leadership and reproductive freedom. This lobby, reinforced by Catholic androcentric theologies, has flourished into a new feminism, a calculated ideology to uphold rigid gender roles. Today, we will hear from panelists and converse together to uncover these roots and explore the church's uneven commitment to women's human rights, particularly in the practice of barring equal participation in leadership. The historian Agnès Desmaizières succinctly summarizes the influence of Beijing 30 years ago. Quote, "At the 1995 Beijing Conference on Women, the delegation from the Holy See succeeded in ensuring that religious views of women were placed prominently on the UN agenda. Yet the situation was not without conflict in the Catholic ranks. The Vatican's recent involvement in this field challenged the authority and influence of longtime Catholic women's organizations, who had, since the birth of the UN, often single-handedly represented the Catholic perspective on women," end quote. Before Beijing, and in the shaping of the final document, the Vatican made it clear that phrases from the preparatory document, such as reproductive rights, safe sex, gender, and safe abortion, represented central moral issues that radically digressed from Catholic values. In response to what John Paul II viewed as a radical feminism that aimed to move beyond gender complementarity and toward the full equality and social inclusion of women, which included their sexual and reproductive rights, the Pope wrote a special letter to women that represented a new feminism for Catholic women in the months preceding the Beijing Conference. In the letter, John Paul II uncharacteristically issues an apology to women for injustices committed in the name of the church, and yet also uplifts the feminine genius of women, a now famous theological phrase, seen as certain biological traits that complement the traits of men and celebrates the female body, especially through its reproductive capacities and the role of motherhood. The gender complementarity framework provides the justification, in part, for John Paul II's apostolic letter on the exclusion from women to ordained ministries, written the same year as the Beijing Conference. The letter to women has its intended effect, and the moderate feminism of Catholic women's organizations, seen as commitment to feminist solidarity and bridge building with secular women's movements, especially around issues of social justice and the global position of Global South women in relationship to poverty and armed conflict, is overshadowed by the emergence of more conservative Catholic women's organizations committed to the role of new feminism. This conservative feminism, rooted in gender complementarity and with the concerns of the family at the forefront of what it means to be a Catholic woman, diluted the Catholic feminist presence at the UN at Beijing, where previously Catholic women were willing to remain ambiguous on certain family principles, such as abortion and LGBTQ issues, in service of certain socioeconomic justice issues. It is these historical and theological dynamics that create the long shadow of Beijing upon which we reflect today. Catholic feminist theology has had to seriously respond to this new feminism and its de-escalation of the urgency of women's leadership and dignity. Joan Chittister, a feminist theologian, Catholic nun, and participant at Beijing, wrote in one of her reflections, quote, "For the first time in history, according to Gertrude Mongella, Secretary General of the conference, women's issues have been recognized as societal issues, issues which, unless we attend to them, will in the long run affect the entire society negatively. Women's issues are the societal issues that measure the health, the quality, the humanity of the whole world. They are also the issues that assess the integrity of theology. If the abuse of half the population of the world can be theologically justified under the rubric of subservience, then any level of inhumanity is possible," end quote. 30 years after Beijing, Chittister's words still feel relevant to both the global status of women and the state of Catholic theology. Without further delay, let's move to our presentations on these complex themes for today and meet our panelists. Maria Consuelo Mejia, an anthropologist, holds a master's degree in political science from UNAM. In 1994, she co-founded and became executive director of Catholics for the Right to Decide Mexico, positioning the organization as a leader in SRHR in Mexico. During more than 20 years, she promoted a feminist critical vision of the institutional Catholic Church through campaigns, special publications, and workshops. In close alliance with Catholics for a Free Choice, she participated in the Sea Change campaign, questioning the role of the Vatican at the United Nations conferences. At the same time, Catholics in Mexico recovered positive arguments from the Catholic tradition in favor of women's human rights. She has received awards from Fuls Feminista, Women Deliver, and several Mexican organizations of human rights defenders. She served as public official at the National Institute of Women for 5 years, and currently she is a member of Fuls Feminista and of Catholics for the Right to Decide Mexico Board of Directors. Welcome, Maria. And I'll give all of our bios at once and then invite our presenters. So next we have Cynthia Rothschild, who is an advocate, trainer, and teacher whose work has revolved around and traveled through social movements in the UN for over 2 decades. In recent years, she's been the director of a UN program at a college in the US and has been a consultant with a focus on NGO and UN advocacy and policy, sexual rights, LGBTI issues, women's human rights defenders, religious fundamentalisms and extremisms, clampdowns on civil society, and HIV and AIDS. She's a member of various global civil society coalitions in the Women Human Rights Defenders International Coalition. An occasional and reluctant author, she's the author of Written Out, How Sexuality is Used to Attack Women's Organizing, the co-author of Sex at Dusk and The Morning After, Sexuality Policy in the U.S. in the Years of Obama, and Gendering Documentation, a manual for and about women's human rights defenders, and finally, Strengthening Resistance, Confronting Violence Against Women and HIV/AIDS. Welcome, Cynthia. Our third panelist who we'll be hearing from and will be attending virtually today is Dr. Regina Franken-Wendelstorff. who is a social scientist who specializes in international politics and theology. She has worked for various international organizations in the field of democracy building in East and Central Africa, and has lectured at various universities and international institutions. Her topics are international cooperation and diplomacy strategies, peace and conflict research, intercultural communication, and forms of religion-based extremism. She was also project manager for several EU research projects on social media and transformation processes in society. She has been on the board of various national and international women's rights organizations and is currently a member of the board of the Catholic Women's Council. And we can give her a round of applause because she's listening on Zoom. And finally, our fourth panelist. For the past 50 years, Frances Kissling has been at the center of public attention when it comes to gender, reproduction, religion, and ethics. Kissling spent 25 years as the president of Catholics for Choice, where she crafted a way of thinking and talking about abortion that challenged the ideas of the Catholic Church and paved a path between the absolutism of orthodoxies. Always feminist, always Catholic, but aimed at the uncommitted public. Kissling was dubbed by the Boston Globe as the philosopher of the pro-choice movement. Kissling was a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard, followed by 3 years as a fellow at the Center for Bioethics in the Medical School at the University of Pennsylvania, where she taught in the master's program in bioethics. For IPPF-WHR, she developed programs for affiliates throughout Latin America to encourage them to move from contraception to reproductive rights, including abortion. For PSI, she developed a program on ethics and abortion for their platforms who were concerned morally as well as practically about providing post-abortion care. She has worked extensively in Mexico on the articulation of a frame of principles, beliefs, and values, helping health professionals understand their perspectives and change. She has published over 250 articles and book chapters and challenged the Vatican at Cairo and Beijing conferences. Kissling is known as one of the most dynamic, funny, and serious thinkers in the field of reproduction. Welcome, Frances. So each of our panelists will begin with a short 5 to 10 minute presentation before we move into a moderated conversation and dialogue. After this conversation, we will be collecting any questions for the panelists on the note cards that you have been provided. And as necessary, I'll be letting our panelists know that their time to speak is up by providing them with a flower. And thanks to Frances for this feminist suggestion. And so without further ado, I turn it over to our first speaker, Maria Mejia.
I'm not Maria. Oh. Just a quick thing. I think some folks were filming and we've not given permission for folks to film. So if you wouldn't mind not filming, and if any of you are here tweeting or generally using social media, either with images or messages, please make us sound smart. And please don't misrepresent us, and make us look good.
Amen.
You know, because that part's important. But seriously, there's some risk in our being here, having this conversation with you. So please, no filming, and please use social media responsibly about this event. Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Oh,
I have here. Do you hear me? Yes. Yes, it's not near. Hello, now? Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon to all of you. Thank you very much for being today with us. I'm very grateful to the Women's Ordination Conference for the invitation to participate in this panel. As you know, the Vatican has always been able to accommodate to changing contexts that have been quite critical of its intentions to influence public policies so that they reflect the Vatican's conservative agenda on issues related to women's rights, particularly sexual and reproductive rights, and here of all the population. One of the results of this accommodative position is that the fight against the so-called gender ideology, which is very important now, was established by the Vatican in Beijing in 1995. And after going through several attempts, such as Don't Mess With My Children, it is currently the spearhead of the ultra-right movement that has gained positions in countries like Spain, Argentina, the United States, Europe, and some others. And it continues to push to gain positions of power over countries and over sectors. Indeed, the shadow of the Vatican over Beijing has been long. When threatened by the campaign to remove the Holy See from the UN, they developed strategies based on their economic and political power to get other governments in the Global South, in addition to Islamic countries, to defend their agenda. They also created civil society organizations of various pro-life professionals and supported the attendance at the UN meetings of anti-right groups from various countries around the world. It was no longer the representative of a religion who was leading the struggle against gender ideology, but rather governments and civil society organizations. For us, the surprise was that the Vatican arrived to Beijing with a rather low profile. Actually, the strongest fight in Beijing was with the Quran, with Islamic groups rather than with the Catholic Church, as it had happened in Cairo, at least from an observer participant perspective. Several factors could have been the cause of this change of attitude. On the one hand, they arrived in Beijing with the burden of having lost in Cairo. At the same time, learned of the advance of the movement questioning the status as a non-permanent observer state at the UN. And furthermore, within the Catholic Church, progressive positions are being strengthened among theologians as well as among the believers who are increasingly distanced from the official teachings of the Church. Perhaps that's why they decided to lower the level of confrontation and did not hinder the process so much. But this attitude may also be a consequence of their changing strategies. The campaign to challenge the Vatican status at the UN Sea Change campaign was launched by Frances Gilding when she was the president of Catholics for Africa Choice. The campaign gained many followers, not only among civil society organizations, but also among governments. For example, the European Community, which openly confronted the Vatican and stated that it was important to remove it from the United Nations because it is not a state, an essential requirement to be part of the UN, but it is the representative of a church. Many reactions were generated, such as, why is it the only church going to be represented and not the others? And if the other churches enter, the United Nations will lose all legitimacy. The supposed impartiality and neutrality of the United Nations breaks down when only one church has privileges that the others do not have. The so-called Holy See is the governing arm of a religious institution and not of a nation. It is possible that showing that contradiction made the Vatican a little less belligerent than how he was in Cairo. During the discussions and tensions generated by the actions of the Vatican and its allies, the Vatican delegation, composed of 14 women and 8 men, invited Catholic women who were at the conference to a meeting. I decided to attend that meeting with the support of Catholics for a Free Choice and Catholics for the Right to Decide. And I arrived to a narrow room with high back chairs, like a kind of church. I hesitated whether to speak or not and thought, here they are going to attack me very hard. When I saw the journalists from the International Women's Health Coalition arriving with 2 other people I knew, I thought at least it would be known that I had been attacked. The Holy See delegate made the presentation. She spoke of the joy she had in her heart for having received the letter from the Pope asking her to be his representative. Then she passed the floor to the audience. I thought it was going to be different. I thought it was going to be a longer speech, but it was just a short presentation, and then she offered the floor. One woman raised a hand and said, "What is the Vatican's position on women's participation in decision making?" Then another one, "What do you think about family? Because we would like to know where single mothers stand in your concept of family." And then another, "What are the Vatican's commitments after this conference?" The representative answered with many evasive arguments, saying that the Vatican's commitments had already been communicated by the Pope in the letter he sent in July, and that they are that the Catholic institutions related to health will give priority to the attention of girls. This was the Vatican's commitment to the platform of action, as mentioned there. Regarding the family, she said that sociology has already established that the only form of family consists of father, mother, and children. "I raised my hand and said that I belong to Catholics for the right to decide," and the delegate's face changed color. She turned red and turned to Monsignor Martin, who was next to her, and said something to him. "I said that I was very happy that the Vatican representative was a woman. It means that the progress, there has been some progress made within the Vatican. But remembering the Christian doctrine teaches us the principles of justice and the defense of human rights, I did not understand how the Vatican prohibited the use of condoms to prevent the spread of a deadly disease, how it did not recognize the mortality of women due to poorly performed abortions, especially considering that abortion is a problem of social justice and human rights. And I did not understand how the rights of people with a different sexual orientation could not be recognized when this was an objective question in many cases, independent from the will of the persons, and a human rights issue." The delegate remained silent. She answered the other two questions and closed the session. She did not answer me a single word. When I got up, some women came up to me to congratulate me, and others to tell me, "I am very sad, you are not a Catholic." Others cursed me, like this, no? With words and gestures. A Spanish nun who had been attending our event in Huayru in the Forum of the Civil Society was very happy with our approach and very much in agreement. There were also many nuns in this group, all in uniform, with the same hairstyle, white blouse, and plaid skirt. When I saw them, I thought, oh my God, they are all pro-life. But what a surprise. At least half of them were questioning the Vatican's positions. There was even a group that kept saying, how was it possible that they did not answer my questions? That we were brave enough to make them to dare to question, and that they supported us, and they invited us to a meeting. For those of us in the Catholics for the Right to Decide and Catholics for a Free Choice group in present in Beijing, coming from Washington, Uruguay, Brazil, Bolivia, and Mexico, the experience of the meeting convened by the Vatican was a sign of hope despite the very closed and aggressive reaction of the delegate, or perhaps because of it. The important thing was that several of the women who were there felt identified with us and recognized the importance of our work. Paradoxically, yesterday, I attended the session organized by the Vatican about motherhood. And even though abortion was mentioned as a negative and destroying issue option for women, the panelists also said repeatedly that women should have the conditions to develop their capacity besides being mothers. Furthermore, one of them, who was with her 6 months baby, crying all the time, said that the unpaid work that women do to maintain their families should be recognized as an important and valuable work. It was curious to note that they all quoted John Paul II. Thank you.
Light is something else. What is that? Oh my God. Shadow, I need a haircut. Look at that. Okay. Hi, everyone. First, I want to say what an honor it is to sit on a panel between Maria Consuelo and Frances. And Barb, we haven't met. And Kate, we're finally meeting in person. But I do want to say that Frances and Maria Consuelo are two of the most creative and committed and courageous activists in this arena, in our movements, and I'm very honored to be sitting between you and sharing this space. And thank you so much for organizing it. There's also something lovely because this is maybe unintentionally intergenerational, and that's actually lovely because that's also about how advocacy work continues and gets passed along and adopted and absorbed in how we work best in our social movements. Okay, thank you. Maria Consuelo flagged a few things that I might scratch at in a little bit more depth, but I do want to acknowledge that you opened the door. First, let's say a little bit more about the Holy See at the UN. And I want to be clear that what I'm about to say, this is not about being anti-religion, all right? This is about having a critique of how religion is used or manipulated in political spaces, and sometimes at the expense of particular communities. But this is not specifically anti-religion, okay? Now, with that said, many people question the fact that the Holy See is the only religious entity that functions with the power of a state. It has, as you said, non-member observer status within the UN system, which Palestine has held up until recently. There's been a little bit of a shift of Palestine's status. But anyway, bottom line, the Holy See is the only, I'm going to repeat it, the only religious entity that functions with the power of a state within the UN system. In 1923, there was an intergovernmental conference that produced something called the Montevideo Convention. And it was the Montevideo Convention on the Rights and Duties of States that basically qualified what, in an odd way, what a state is, what the criteria of a state in a multilateral universe is. And I won't go into a lot of that detail, but part of the criteria is having a defined territory, a government, the ability to enter into relations with other states, and a permanent population. Now, between the Holy See, Vatican City, and based on population, much of which is non-citizens and affluent population, actually the Holy See as an entity does not fully meet the criteria of a state. So that's number one. Then it's a question of what they actually do in the space. Some argue, and Maria Consuelo, I think that you flagged this, you know, what is it that gives the Holy See power within this space as a Catholic entity? What denies that right to other religious institutions? What does it mean that it's this, you know, what does it mean that it's this body only with that level of stature? And then on the other side of that, there are folks who believe that multilateral governance ought to be secular, and that the balancing is not having all the other religions coming in with political power, but figuring out how to maintain governance that is secular. One thing that's complicated is that the Holy See claims to follow a moral code rather than rule of law, and it's rule of law that governs within multilateral governance spaces. Okay, so there's also, and all of this is very nuanced, I'm just flagging the biggest picture. So some argue that the presence is inherently discriminatory. Some argue about, they make a secular argument. I will say that what you touched on in terms of the Sea Change campaign was so brilliant. And have any people in this room heard of the Sea Change campaign? Okay, well, one thing that was so amazing when you did this was that you hired a boat that went up and down the East River, and at that time the cafeteria in the UN had glass walls facing well, facing Long Island City, big glass walls. So you had this big boat that had this banner that's, did it say Sea Change? S-E-E, it said Sea Change. And it just went up and down so that all, you know, all the delegates eating lunch in the UN cafeteria across the street could see the boat going back and forth. I thought that was fantastic. Okay. The Holy See can function as a signatory of treaties, and this gets a little bit tricky. There are two treaties in particular, the Convention Against Torture and the Convention on the Rights of the Child. For those of you who are political science nerds, you know that if a state agrees, if it ratifies and signs a treaty, it agrees to be held accountable to the provisions in that treaty. And this is also where the Holy See is quite challenged, because it doesn't want to be held accountable and goes to various lengths, both in terms of compliance, being measured in compliance with relation to the Convention Against Torture and also the CRC. And a lot of people say that the Holy See itself covers itself, will not allow itself to be reviewed properly because of the decades-long sex abuse scandal of the church. They don't want to be held accountable to the provisions of the Convention on the Rights of the Child because of the decades-long issues with abuse of young people and sexual abuse. So that's an important piece to note. Also, again, you can't play a game where sometimes you're claiming moral authority and sometimes you're functioning, you're claiming legal authority. The Holy See is uniquely positioned to do both when it chooses to do each, right? So there's something tricky. About that. I'm going to jump to echo some of the points about the Holy See's fairly recent history within the UN. In addition to Beijing, there was the International Conference on Population and Development at Cairo the year before. And then there's also, it's important to note, the International Criminal Court proceedings, you know, the Rome Statute, where the Holy See was extremely vocal in negotiation and extremely upset with some of the directions that the negotiations were taking. And it was also within the context of the ICC. And even my movement folks were not as good as we need to be to always point to the International Criminal Court proceedings. We need to look at that as an historic site where the Holy See engaged in ways that were limiting around gender in particular. Let me say this, that after the Cairo meeting on population and development in 94, Pope John Paul II referred to that meeting as the work of the devil. So there were strong opinions articulated about the negotiation and about the results. Let's come back to gender. In all of this work, there is an anti-gender position that the Holy See and others have promoted for many, many, many years, many decades, actually. Let me just do a quick definitional piece here. There's a reason that many of us have advocated for the importance of understanding gender beyond sex. And just to remind us, the reason for that is that sex is generally biological, and gender takes into account power. It takes into account social roles. It takes into account the realities of people's lives. So gender is a more inclusive term that speaks to how power around issues of sex and sexuality and physical bodies, gender is important, right? It speaks to something bigger than just the biological piece. And I think that that is very important right now in this moment when many of us hear about gender ideology. And we can spend a long time talking about that. You flagged it. But I want to say a few things, and I want to implicate the United States government right now. We cannot talk about gender ideology in this moment without looking at the policies of the United States government and others, not just the US, which are in lockstep with the most conservative religious, I'm not even going to call them teachings, I don't know whether to call them teachings or not, but in lockstep with the most conservative analyses in terms of Christian and Catholic doctrine, also true for other religions as well. So gender ideology I believe, is a manipulated project with roots in the church, but promoted as a political project. It manifests in anti-gender language at the UN with efforts to sort of reify the notion of sex as male and female and have that be the most important thing rather than what we understand gender to be more generally. And I think it's really important to note that gender, anti-gender sentiment is used in different ways, but we can't talk about it in this moment, in March, in this country, without talking about anti-transgender sentiment and how trans communities have been targeted, are getting manipulated politically in ways that cause so much pain, that increase the context of violence and discrimination, and are filled with meanness. And there's a way in which anti-trans sentiment, whether it's out of the church and the history of the Vatican and the history of the Holy See, or whether it's right now in terms of US policy, but I want to argue also that there's an economic rationale for some of this. It's not just being anti-gender generally, and I'm going to use a quick example that warrants much more exploration than I'll go into. About 2 hours ago, I got a notification on my phone, as we're all obsessed with breaking news, that the federal government in the U.S. was withholding $175 million to the University of Pennsylvania. And the lead in that story was because of the University of Pennsylvania's positions on transgender and other issues of so-called diversity, equity, inclusion, which I think are better framed as anti-discrimination efforts. So that's $175 million away from the University of Pennsylvania, in addition to $400 million that got withheld from Columbia University around complicated issues of manipulated stories around clampdowns on protest in relation to Palestine. And questions that the federal government has about whether the administration of Columbia is doing enough to protect Jewish students on campus. This is all a mess. This is Islamophobia. This is anti-Semitism. This is the economic piece, an effort to destroy higher education, and this is an effort using ideas about gender and other ideas to financially gut education systems, whether it's elementary schools, high schools, or whether it's colleges. In the last week, we're talking about $575 million that has been taken from two schools only. And let me connect this to gender again and drop more directly. Part of the goal around school systems for the United States is to create distrust around a public education system. And it is about the United States government and others saying, your school system, where you're using books that talk about different genders and where you're talking about books that deal with racism and all these so-called crazy ideas. Again, I'm speaking as the United States government right now, all right? You're teaching these things that are dangerous to children. Therefore, there's a problem with the public school system. Therefore, we're going to cut funding for the public school system. Therefore, either teach your kids at home or send them for religious schooling. Therefore, there's this huge problem with the public school system. Therefore, let's privatize the schools. That, in this example, I think is, if not the ultimate goal, then one. But that comes at the expense of queer folks and trans folks and folks who are trying to do anti-discrimination work in a number of arenas. My main point here is that the teachings have come from the church. They've come from right-wing NGOs, some of which may be in this room. They've come from a linking of the highest levels of the church but functioning in political arenas and now functioning in domestic educational arenas also. I probably need to stop, right? All right. Okay. I'm very upset. Okay.
We might get two.
Yeah. Let me wrap for one minute. Gender ideology, as it's professed and articulated as a thing in the world, it's manipulated. Trans folks are not coming for our kids. Trans folks want to, you know, there's no recruitment, there's no evidence, there's no data for risk in terms of transgender folks. And, you know, this is just, it's manipulated craziness. So your takeaway is to realize that part of the teachings of the church that manifest in negotiations at the UN, they come at the expense of people's sense of safety and dignity, all right? That's also true in terms of abortion and sexuality education and all the things that Maria Consuelo mentioned. The Holy See tends to function in a very conservative way with some exceptions across the street at the UN and in ways that are... That create context for more human rights violations rather than solve them. I'll close on a positive note simply by saying that Pope Francis has actually made, if we look at sexual orientation in particular, has actually made some very strong statements, affirming and sensitive and reasonable statements that, he doesn't use this language, but queer folks, but he doesn't use that language, but... that people should not be targeted for violence and discrimination. And there's a discrepancy between what the Pope has been saying in the last few years and what the bishops are implementing and what the political folks across the street are actually arguing. Okay, thanks.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. Next we'll hear from Dr. Regina Franken. And so we'll pull up our virtual speaker now.
Good afternoon. There were conferences on the 1990s. We'll characterized by global cooperation, social justice, and equal participation in society. Religions, and the Catholic Church in particular, were seen by many women as peacemakers, as an important social force, a safe space, and as an important partner in the development of women towards equal rights and equal values. Since the World Conference on Women, women around the world have been demanding that the Church take a global leadership role in the protection and recognition of human rights, because women's rights are human rights. But even in the run-up to the Beijing Conference, there were numerous coalitions seeking to relativize human rights in the name of religion, and to establish separate rights for women according to religious beliefs. And a coalition of Catholic Church and Islamic countries lobbied against equal rights for women. To this day, the Vatican's numerous delegations and commissions only appoint women who support a traditional image of women and therefore propagate an ideology that serves to maintain strict gender roles. However, even the Vatican does not question the importance of human rights for all people, at least not publicly. But especially in the context of women's rights, there is still a yes-but relativization that makes the formal recognition of human rights meaningless. Yes, All people are equal, and governments should enable women to participate more in social life. But this does not automatically lead to equal rights, certainly not for women in church. Yes, we are against violence against women and sexualized violence in war, but we reject its categorization as a crime against the right to sexual self-determination or as a crime against humanity, as laid down in various international declarations. Because these regulations contradict Christians and family values and are contrary to the teachings of the Church. Yes, we are in favor of protecting mothers and children, but contraceptives and sex education contradict our moral guidelines of the Church. Women die in agony from bleeding, infection, and intoxication as a result of too many and too early pregnancies. Yes, the Church is in favor for climate protection, but at the same time, the Vatican, together with Russia and many Islamic countries, oppose the declaration in Baku, which was intended to protect women from the violence caused by climate change. Obviously, because the word gender-based violence in the declaration also includes trans women. Above all, the concepts of gender ideology created by the Vatican serve as an excuse to deny women their rights in many yes-but relativizations. In fact, women are witnessing an increase in religious and political campaigns by religious organizations, but also by state and non-state actors who use religious freedom to restrict women's human rights worldwide or to prevent women from exercising their rights. Statements such as the importance of restoring white religious teachings or education according to God's guidance are repeatedly included in statements on women's rights by the Church. This is possible because the Vatican has created a worldwide network of unholy coalitions between evangelical communities, Islamic and autocratic rulers, and old boys' networks. The Vatican uses this patriarchal coalition, especially in the context of international conferences, to extend its influence and to prevent the implementation of laws which are meant to protect women. In addition to this and the yes but relativization, they also use the concept of a patriarchal and paternalistic oppressive care behavior. Catholic and Islamic representatives acknowledge the human right of all people to education. But they specify what education means for women according to religious moral concepts. Of course, out of poor concern for women's life. Although they recognize that women must be freed from historical and cultural constraint, they only oppose those that go against the principles of their own faith. And bishops speaking on the sidelines of the synod confess that women are limited by religious patriarchal stereotypes, and in a helpful and caring manner, they pointed out that the Church would now seek to redefine them. True to the motto, ordained man know how women can lead a happy and fulfilled life. Paternalistic oppressive care behavior can also be found. Good afternoon. The World Conferences of the 1990s.
Apologies. on its own.
Good afternoon. The World Conferences of the 1990s.
I'm so sorry.
It's just like a technical difficulty. Apologies. We will see if we can get the last couple of minutes of her video back up and running.
Maybe I can say the last paragraph on my own.
Oh, certainly.
Okay, so let me continue. I can listen to you later. So, okay, let me just continue this last. What I said last is that ordained men always think that they know how women can lead a happy and fulfilled life. But paternalistic and this oppressive care behavior can also be found when the church justifies the exclusion of women, this the need to protect them from harmful clericalism. Especially under Pope Francis, this argument is used to justify discrimination against women. So if you put these three together, the paternalistic strategy of oppressive care behavior, the yes but relativization, and the patriarchal network, that all help the Vatican and its collaborators to maintain structures of discrimination against women, and not only in church, but also in the broader society, as we have heard from Cynthia during the last discussion, during the last speech. So if we ask ourselves now today, about 30 years later, whether our expectation, what we had, that the church as a global player was an important partner in the development of women's participation or in the realization of their rights to self-determination and the protection of women, then unfortunately, we have to say, and yes, it is unfortunately, but we have to come to the conclusion that in 1995, we simply had been wrong. Before, the church would be helpful, but now, 30 years later, we actually realize that this was not the case. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Regina. We had Regina pre-record her talk just to anticipate Wi-Fi issues, but we had to have a mistake that we got to hear a little bit from her. And she'll be on Zoom with us throughout the Q&A, as well.
You just let me know.
Okay.
And so to last but not least, we have our final speaker, Frances.
Okay. All right. The 4:30 slot on any program is the worst slot in the world. Because you have cocktail parties to go to, and you're tired, you're listening to stuff all day long, and my job is to keep you entertained and to make sure you do not leave the room. I have seen, while I've been sitting there, a few people wander out of this room before I have gotten a chance to speak, and I am really offended by such behavior. That's why I'm standing up and moving around a little bit, because I'm going to be watching. And those of you who leave before I am finished are going on my permanent list. I will not say what kind of list it is, but I think you know exactly what I am talking about. Okay, so with that out of the way, what I'm going to try to do in my time is talk a little bit about some practical stuff. As a Catholic who has spent a long time challenging the institutional church without an ounce of fear, because there's nothing they can do to me, nothing they can do to me, I want to give people some clues in this. I'll talk about some substantive stuff if I have time, but also some clues about how do you deal with an institution like the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, I've always talked about it, and I tell my Protestant, Christian, Jewish, etc. friends, part of their problem is wardrobe problem. If you have the clothes that the cardinals and the pope have, people pay attention to you. But if you get up there with, you know, a little white collar and a little black suit, forget it. Nobody pays attention to you. So, you know, the Catholic Church has had a long time to develop, the Institute of Church, long time to develop all the vehicles that they can use in order to be powerful. Money, wardrobe, statehood, etc., etc., etc. And using it sometimes in good ways and sometimes in bad. The other thing I want to talk about when we talk about what's going on in the period of the 70s and the five UN conferences that took place in that period of time, each of which marked in secular society a great shift in how the UN looked at things. You know, the environmental conference, the population conference, the women's conference, the sustainable development conference, and the human rights conference. In each and every one of those conferences, women were included, not as much as they should, but were women and women's issues were included in ways that they had not been included in prior conferences. Those were that 10 years of the 70s with these conferences marked a significant international change in the way things went. Now, the title of this is In the Shadow of the Vatican. The Vatican was not the only Catholic player in the UN. Okay. It was not the only religious player in the UN. There are other religions who have participated in the UN in very meaningful ways, from the Quakers, the Baha'is, even religions that we don't think about very much, who really played enormously dialogic roles from the beginning of this, and the Episcopate, all of the Christian denominations as well. So when I think about how the Vatican and right-wing, conservative, Catholic, primarily anti-abortion organizations, because abortion was a key issue no matter what the conference was about. How those two entities, the Vatican as a state, which has about as much right in the UN as Disneyland, by the way, if you look at what the Vatican has going for it in terms of numbers, in terms of everything else, well, you know, Disney World and France could become a member of the UN too, under those requirements. But at any rate, the Vatican played a certain kind of role in this dynamic of all of the meetings, and all these NGOs were the real bad guys. You know, those of us who were there, remember who was in the audience when you spoke, who came up to you as you were trying to go up the elevator to tell you you were a horrible human being. It was not the Monsignor, it was not the bishop, it was some kid from some conservative Catholic college around the country who accosted you or tried to take over your meetings. And also it was very powerful organizations within Catholicism, like Opus Dei. You know, where did the money come from for a lot of this kind of stuff? So when I look at this panoply of what went on, how did they have the influence that they had, it had a lot to do not just with the official institution, but the way the official institution used lay people. Okay. I remember at the Rio Conference on Population, the Rio Conference on Environment was really the first of the conferences. And there was, and the Vatican is very smart in many ways. At the Vatican, what the PR that came out of that conference was that the feminists and the Vatican were in bed together, because we feminists spoke out against things like, no, the only problem with the environment is not that women are having too many babies, The problem is that too many corporations are cutting down all the trees. You know? And so, and the church used that kind of opportunity to look somewhat more liberal in saying, no, we can't have the, you know, like we're not going to get into population control in the environmental movement. So those were kinds of things that you had going on in each and every one of these conferences. So how does a group, now also I'm going to add to this, in the 70s, when these the first round of conferences happened, Catholics for Choice was one of the only Catholic groups in resistance to what the Vatican was up to. Women's Ordination Conference was nowhere. All of the organizations of, you were nowhere. I don't know where you were, because you weren't in Rio.
You wasn't born.
You weren't born.
Yeah.
Right? Thank God, you got born and you got born again. So that you got involved in this. So that a lot of this was left to Catholics for Choice globally to really do this. We were still fighting a battle with other progressive Catholic groups to be recognized as being allowed to be part of the progressive Catholic community. So, you know, we were on our own. You know, and when you're on your own, you either fold or you get really strong. You do not fool around. Okay. So for example, someone mentioned the Sea Change campaign. Well, how did the Sea Change campaign come about with Catholics for Choice? It came about because no group of any denomination or any secular group was allowed to demonstrate in front of the UN. I think you probably are still not allowed to demonstrate in front of the UN. And so we're sitting around thinking, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to handle this? You're not allowed to demonstrate. Well, we're going to get a boat. We rented a sailboat. 50 people, there are still people who come up to me and say, I was on the boat. I was on the boat. You were not on the boat. All of that. And we went back and forth and back and forth. And we had gotten permission to do this from the police. But a little police boat comes out because somebody inside the Vatican, inside the UN, says those people should not be there. And some cops come up to the boat, in their boat, and we have to defend our right to be there and to do this. But you have to, when you are dealing with a monolithic institution with a lot of power and a lot more money, there are several things that are important. And they're still important in these UN conferences. And one of them is, you can't be afraid. You know, you cannot be afraid. Nothing bad is going to happen. I mean, David and Goliath, which is what we are, you know, we're Davida and they're Goliath, okay? David is popular, you know. Resistance is popular, more so than you might think. And they like people, the world, the media, everybody else. They love people who step out. You know, we just step out there and don't be afraid. So, for example, you have to be creative. You have to use bold. You have to talk about Disneyland. You have to do all of those kinds of things to get paid attention to. The other thing is when you're dealing with the institutional church, many Catholics, and certainly non-Catholics, believe they have to be nice. You know, it's a religion, you know. And again, you know, that they're dressed up nicely. So you don't take them on in the same way you would take on, you know, some normal right-wing group. Polite. Well, that's how pomposity is what keeps them in power. pompous people, think about it in your daily life. Pompous people tend to get away with a lot of crap. Okay. And that's what the Vatican does. It gets away with a lot of crap because it's so pompous about what it does. So you have to burst the balloon of pomposity. Pompous people, arrogant people, which I have no problem saying a lot of our leaders in the churches are pompous people, not just Catholics, but other religions too. They don't like it if they get made fun of. So I am the master of making fun of pompous people. Okay. So for example, I was doing a radio program one day around one of these meetings, and Benedict was Pope at that time, and the person said to me, "Well, what do you think of Pope Benedict?" And I said, "Well, I think he is the greatest mind of the 5th century. when you can make fun of people who deserve to be made fun of, people remember those things more than anything else. And the other thing is, when you can make people laugh, as you are doing now, they stay awake. If you can't tell at least one joke in your presentation, you lose a lot of people. So you have to, if you are fighting with something that's bigger than you, you have to be prepared to be willing to not be so respectful. People who do not deserve to be respected should not be respected, plain and simple. And so those of us who are, I don't go to these meetings anymore, but I'm home, you know, sleeping at 6 o'clock because I'm so old. but if you go to these meetings, I'm sure there are still these incidents where the Vatican, you know, comes out, or even certain governments, okay, come out. I'm the only one getting flowers, you know, I want the flowers. So you really have to be prepared to go out a little bit on the edge and to understand that you're not going to lose anything. You have nothing to lose. We have nothing to lose if we are just honest, straightforward, don't take them so seriously, and do not let them take over. So I'm going to stop there. I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope you enjoyed it.
Francis, and thank you so much to all of our speakers. I think that Kate will walk around and collect note cards. If you have a written question that you would like to ask the panelists, please give those to Kate as she walks around. And while Kate is doing that, I'll open it back up to our panelists. If anyone would like to respond to anything that you've heard from your colleagues, or any new insights that you would like to share, I'll open it up for some maybe like 1 or 2 minute brief responses to what you've heard.
I'll ask a question.
Okay.
Good. I'll ask a question of the other panelists, and that is, can you tell us one little narrative of something that happened in any one of these meetings that has happened over the last 30 years, something that strikes you as interesting for people to know, something that struck you in an important way?
I already told my narrative. I already told mine, so and it was like a kind of testimony. So, but I was, and when the other one is the boat, I was in the boat, so it was. That was also very impressive. No, something that struck me was the discipline of the feminist movement to defend the agenda. It was really, really incredible. From 6 in the morning to 11 or 12, and again the next day from 6 in the morning to 11 or 12. Multiple meetings, etc. And maybe one thing that can be said is that when the discussion about inheritance for women, there was a declaration of the representative from Ghana. Is he from Ghana? I don't remember exactly. From Ghana, saying that that they will go forward with allowing women to have the properties to be subject of inheritance. Mm-hmm. And that was like breaking everything, because she would be, I suppose, very bad treated by the government afterwards. I don't know. I don't remember that.
I can let others go.
Regina, I wanted to see if you might have anything to say, just given your online status. I wanted to invite you to speak in particular.
Yes. Okay, don't worry. I'm just thinking about your question. But what I remember very well is that prior to the Beijing conference, in many African countries, we had numerous workshops and discussion with women groups. And it was impressive to see how women were talking about the situation and how clearly they knew about religion-based sexism. So that was nothing which was an individual personal feelings. Many women have been aware that it is a systemic experience, that it is a systemic problem, even in many African countries. What really worried me was when we as the diplomatic community were invited later on by the bishops to see who was sent to Beijing. We couldn't find one of these women. All the delegation were mostly traditional, conservative, and all the work what had been done by the women at the grassroots level was just disappearing, and that was a big problem for many women's organizations, because they said, why did we do all this work? Why were we speaking all the times? And now no one in Beijing is listening to us. And this had so many, many other conferences which I attended to, that it was the same way.
Thank you, Regina.
I don't have to say anything if you want to go to the cards. Go
to the cards. There's one, there are two there.
Also, if you have cards, you can simply bring them up here. I'll collect them. Okay, yeah. I think I wanted to affirm Cynthia's kind of observation about the sort of intergenerational kind of nature of our panel, but also this space in particular, and that being just an important part of advocacy work generally. And I think that this question speaks well to that. As a Mexican recent MD graduate born and raised in the Catholic Church with a minister father and Sunday school mother, I am extremely happy to be a part of this important day. My question would be, how are we going to integrate youth in this topic, specifically young Catholic girls? I come from a conservative Catholic college and would love to help influence people like me and be there to face the challenges I come from. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. In Mexico, there is an organization, Catholic for the Right to Decide, maybe I mentioned it, and they have different kinds of training programs. They do social media to integrate young people, women and men, on this struggle. And they have responded very well. They are very interested, and they have responded very well. Once upon a time, there was a national network of young Catholics for the Right to Decide people. Now they are working in not in a network, but each one by themselves. but they continue to be interlinked with the organization through social media and through the web page of Católicas Mexico. And if somebody wants to have more, to be able to do more, you can get in touch with Católicas Mexico through the web page. And thank you.
Okay. I like this one, and I think this one is implicitly directed at Francis. Can we hear more of the jokes you made to make fun of the bishops, the hierarchy? Any more of your jokes or stories you'd like to share?
You want me to think of more jokes? They want me to tell more jokes?
Ones you've told or used before, if you can remember any. Or off the cuff.
John Paul jokes. Do you have a good John Paul joke?
I can't think of one off the top of my head. But, I mean, I think it's just a willingness, what I would say, is around telling jokes just saying things that are... Don't be afraid of being outrageous. Okay? This is about outrage. And there are different ways of doing outrage. There are people who do outrage from anger. Okay, it doesn't work a lot, in my opinion. I mean, people don't really respond that much when somebody is angry. You know, I mean, we've done a lot of anger in our lives. And people are looking for something a little lighter, outrage of a different form. So I think that it is trying to develop, if you don't think that way automatically, something that's more creative. Mm. I mean, like the boat was creative, okay? Or not being afraid to be, try to be critical in a way that is not nasty. You know, nastiness gets you nowhere, believe me. I know, because I can be really nasty, but it never works. So really being allowing yourself to make to be funny. Okay, that's all, and you can do it.
Do you have anything else?
Theater play. She's doing the women called in Vatican. And they all use the arguments men usually use to prevent women from priesthood and diaconate. And they ask, why should men become priests? So they had a female pope, and they broadcasted it. So you can see it on YouTube. And also other organizations start using humor as a method to work against the discrimination of women. Like in Germany, there is a women's group. They just created a mock a calendar using the arguments brought from the church against them. So I think there are many. It's starting now that women's organizations are using humor as a kind of a method.
I'll say one more thing.
Yeah.
Quick. I think the other thing about this is stories are very important. In my work, I rarely have convinced anybody to change their mind on the basis of facts. I'm sorry for all of you scientists and all you people who have a lot of facts going on, but I generally find that when I get into a lot of facts, people's eyes glaze over. But stories are critical, and we all have these stories. I mean, one story about women and the church, is the other thing about the church, which we haven't mentioned, is if you're looking at the Catholic angle of things, you know, what about all of the bad things that the church has done around any one of a number of issues? So for example, there was a nun who did a survey maybe 15, 20 years ago, of the way in which priests treat nuns. Okay, child sex abuse. You can't let people get away with that kind of behavior, no matter what the topic is. You can still bring it up. And there was a story that really impressed me and that I used to use a lot, and that was the story of a priest in Africa who was, and nuns in Africa are abused with great regularity by priests. This is a serious problem. And this priest was having an affair with a woman, a nun. She became pregnant. He took her for an abortion. She died. And he officiated at her funeral. Now, that's the kind of thing that gets people. That sort of stuff is really, that's real. Okay.
Thank you. We have two last questions. Penultimate question, what are some of the theological arguments that can be used for good in the UN processes? And as the theologian here, I might offer some thoughts, and Regina as well.
Regina. I'm gonna keep it talking. We are not theologians, but I can say something.
Yeah, I wanted, I think that this also connects to the earlier question that we had regarding like what advice for young girls or like advice for girls in like conservative Catholic contexts. And I wanted to just mention that I think especially the tradition of liberation theology very much emerged out of Catholic spaces in Latin America, ecclesial-based communities. And out of that tradition, there has emerged a sort of feminist Catholic approach that tries to retrieve some fundamental Catholic principles and deconstruct the patriarchal ways that they have been used, and then reimagine Catholic theology out of that process. And some of these women were actually the founders of our group, Women's Ordination Conference. People like Elizabeth Schuessler Fiorenza, Rosemary Radford Ruther, Ada Maria Isasi Diaz, and so many others. So what I would kind of like advice I would give, especially to young women growing up in the Catholic Church, is maybe reading some of these women and kind of like discovering your own tradition was something that was very like empowering. To myself, and we have a resource page on that on our website, if you go to our Women's Ordination website.
We can move on. Some insights from of what the previous question said. The thing is that you have to have in mind that what the Catholic hierarchy has taught us and what we have heard is partial. It's only one part. There is not one interpretation of the doctrine. There is not only one theology. Now we have feminist theology, Indian theology, queer theology, and this is what represents the people within the Catholic Church. And of course, the feminist theology has given us a lot of basis to understand that we can be women, we can have an abortion, and we can continue to be Catholic. The other part of all this is surveys. In Mexico, there were a lot, like four national surveys to know what is happening with the Catholic opinion around these issues. And we can say that around 70 to 80% of the Catholic population do not agree with these teachings of the Catholic Church. So the unveiling all these things based on human rights principles. What is it? What we can bring to the United Nations? Human rights, freedom of conscience, justice, because you can find those on these teachings also, and you can have another interpretation or another narrative of the role that Maria Magdalena had, You know, the fact she's portrayed as a sexual worker or something like that, and well, maybe she was, but it doesn't mean that she had not the possibility to create and to be some trends within the Catholic Church say that she was the person chosen by Christ to continue the church, not Peter. It was her. So the thing is, you have to unveil yourself and to deconstruct what you have heard and try to learn the new realities from what is happening and from people, from concrete people.
Thank you so much. We have just a few minutes left, and I think this is a really great last question. You have a magic megaphone that will broadcast a single message to everyone within a 5-block radius of the UN. You have a chance to convey a single point on the topic of this panel through the magic microphone. What do you say?
Cynthia. No, I said a lot.
This is like, you know, the television show Shark Tank. This is like, this is a little bit like, you know, yeah. what's your sales pitch? Don't we know?
Right.
Yeah.
Resisting the mighty and all evil is the foundation of our faith. And women in the church have always resisted throughout all the centuries.
Can you say that one more time from the beginning?
Okay. I would say, resisting the mighty and all evil is the foundation of our faith, and women in the church have always resisted throughout all the centuries. And there are plenty of stories, there are plenty of books, articles about the history of women in church and about feministic theology. So just go ahead and read them.
I'll take a crack at this, but I feel like I want 5 opportunities because I want 5 different messages. I would say, really think about what is the real threat? What is the real undercurrent? When you hear something conservative, or when you hear something that denigrates the dignity of a group, or when you hear threats to women's bodily autonomy, or when you hear about, you know, fear of collapse of the family or collapse of society, what is, go aerial, you know, that what is it called when you're flying at 39,000 feet? What is really going on? Is there an economic imperative, or is it about an election? You know, is it about political power? I would say my message would be, really think about what's the undercurrent? What's actually really happening underneath the conservative mean or restrictive messaging or policies?
I'll go.
I think one of the things that's important, I mean, this is not so much, you know, your 30-second advertisement that I'm going to do. But I think that you have to think a lot about what grabs people. Okay. Now, you know, my shtick is facts do not grab people. I don't tell anybody any facts because, first of all, I don't know any. And second of all, those facts have never done me any good whatsoever. Okay. I've never responded to facts. But I respond to values. I'm a values-oriented person. And I think a lot about the sound of words. Words have, each individual word has a sound, and they're different in different languages. So when I think in English. So for example, the word rights is harsh. Rights. I don't like it. I don't use it because I think it drives people crazy. And I'm interested in people who don't agree with me totally. I'm not interested in the people who are like, human rights, you know, keep your rosary off my ovaries, I think about, I mean, that's another one, I should have thought of for the other question, but that was coined by a Jesuit priest, by the way. I think of things like words, like the word freedom. The sound of the word, and I'm talking English again because it may not work in other languages. The word freedom has a certain resonance with people, more than the word rights does. Rights is part of modern I love rights, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, rights is part of the modern polarization that we are going through. Women's rights, men's rights. Women's rights, fetuses' rights. You know, rights conflict. I don't want to deal with conflict. I want to deal with things that are not. Everybody loves freedom. Everybody loves compassion. So thinking about those value-oriented words that go into people's hearts rather than their minds when you're working on this stuff, to me, is I find it in my own work more effective. Everybody may find different things, but and I'm not down anybody, you know, there's an audience for everything. You have to decide who your audience is before you can decide what the message is. If your audience is people, in my opinion, who are already firmly committed to women's rights, gay rights, trans rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, well, there's one set of messages that you use for people like that. Your goal is to rev them up to do more of what they already believe in. If your goal is to reach out to people who are not in that space, which actually, in most cases, the majority of people are not in the hard line spaces on any one of the issues we're talking about, then you have to think of the kind of words or the kind of messages that are going to move them or resonate. There's a linguistic element to this that has to do with how words sound. Each word has a sound, and think about that.
Please join me in one last round of applause for our panelists.